Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. It's Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio. I am Jim Christina, your host, and this is The Writer's Block. Here in studio tonight with Bobby Jean Bell, who's sitting over there looking just like somebody who just stole her horse. We have her husband, Jim, here, sitting here, actually, just coming in the door. And with us in studio tonight is one of our favorite people, Henry Park.
I stole the horse.
And he stole the horse. So there's that. And I have to mea culpa here because, well, first of all, let me welcome everybody to 2016, because that's like, wow.
Well, here we are. Can you believe it's January 7th, 2016?
I never dreamed in my billion years that I would ever live this long. And I just had a birthday, and I'm not giving you numbers.
How many candles?
66.
Wow.
I didn't have enough wind to blow them all out.
It's the same number forwards and backwards.
There you go. One more and I could be the devil.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We have with us tonight, via phone, a gentleman who's a member of the Western Writers Association. He was on the board of Mystery Writers. He has written several novels. The guy has just got more awards than first novel awards that I could count. He's got two paragraphs full of them, and I'm just like, he's got books of the year. He's more popular than James Bond and Harry Bosch.
And rightfully so.
And I got to tell you, and this gentleman, well, I'll tell you who it is. It's Craig Johnson, the originator of Longmire, Walt Longmire Mysteries. That, of course, is just a great Netflix TV show. One of my favorites, actually. Craig lives in a little town in Wyoming, Ucross, with a population of
25.
We have him on the line now, and we're going to have him join you right now. You with us, Craig?
Easy on all that horse stealing talk. That's a felony here in Wyoming. You got to be careful about that.
Do they still hang you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh,
well, there you go. Wow, it's such an honor to have you with us.
Somebody's pickup truck or something.
It is such an honor to have you with us.
Oh, my pleasure, please. Absolutely my pleasure.
How in the world did you wind up in a little town with 25 people?
You know, when I was in my 20s, I was working for a rancher up in Montana, and he needed some horses driven down to Wyoming. A fellow was coming up from Oklahoma to meet and get these horses. And so I volunteered for the job. It was about an eight-hour drive. And so I drove down and got to this little place called Ucross, Wyoming. It had a little bar in it, and it had a public corral, which kind of gives you an indication of what Ucross is like. We don't have a payphone, but we've got a public corral. And anyway, this guy was supposed to meet me here, and I got here, and he wasn't here, so I went over to the bar and called the rancher that I was working for up in Montana, and I said, "Hey, he's not here yet." And he goes, "Well, don't worry, he'll be along any time now. He hasn't left yet." And I said, "From Oklahoma, he hasn't left yet." And he said, yeah, but, you'll find something to do. It's baling season, so, I pitched bales for a bunch of the local ranchers and, never bought a meal for myself, and had slept on top of a horse trailer out there, right next to the public corral. And just kind of fell in love with the place and thought, boy, if I ever get the chance, this might be where it is that I want to build my ranch. And as it turned out, it took me a while to get back around to it, but I finally did.
Wow. That's amazing. I've never even been through a town that's only got 25 people. I honest to God, I didn't know they existed. Oh, let's talk a little bit about Longmire. Then we're going to get into some of the stuff that you did before you were a writer. How did you come up with Walt Longmire? Because he has got to be one of the greatest characters ever to hit fiction.
You know, he was a little bit, in a sense, you know, kind of a counter, you know, product, you know, was what he turned out to be to a certain extent. Whenever I sat down and started thinking about, you know, doing a procedural, you know, that was the time when all the CSI stuff was really kind of exploding. Everything was all about the forensics and the ballistics, you know, and the DNA evidence and all this stuff. And I happened to run into a Wyoming you know, detective for the Division of Criminal Investigation, and I asked him, I said, how long does it take you guys to get DNA evidence? And he pauses for a second, and he says, is this a high-profile case? And I said, yeah, let's pretend like it's a high-profile case. And he goes, about 9 months. And so it seemed to me that what they were doing on television and a lot of these books and everything just, you know, really wasn't particularly honest. And so what I did was is I, you know, went and, you know, interviewed a bunch of sheriffs, you know, and got the idea that, you know, okay, well, you know, this is more of an old school style. You know, when you don't have the resources and you don't have the money and you don't have all of the things that, you know, like, you know, a lot of these larger police departments have, you know, you really got to kind of work, you know, by your wits. And so what I thought was, well, what if you started doing a, you know, a procedural, where the protagonist was the sheriff of the you know, the least populated county and the least populated state in America, you know, because there are only a 500,000 people in the whole state of Wyoming.
Right.
And so I thought, you know what, that might be a direction to go in, you know, then rather than going, you know, with what it seems like everybody else is trying to do. And that's how Walt Longmire came to be.
He's such a great guy. You know, it's just like I love the books, and then I also love the TV show. And it seems like they did a good job casting, what's his name?
Robert Taylor.
He's not as big as the Walt Longmire in your books, but
just about. He almost is.
Like, but his attitude is
Robert's
the same.
Robert's like 6'3" and yeah, about, I don't know, 210, 220 or something like that. But you know, the Walt that's in the books is like about 6'5" and weighs about 260 some pounds.
Right.
You know, he in some ways is also, you know, even his physical build in a lot of ways is a little bit different. You know, in response, you know, to a lot of the stuff that's in crime fiction, because it's usually the 6'2" of twisted steel, the sex appeal. Every woman wanted him, every man feared him. You know, he's the number two Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds. You know, and in case you can't tell, I hate that character more than any character in the world. You know.
Well, that's what
you think. You know, I think because, like, you know, it's not the guy that I'm looking at in the mirror, you know, and I get up in the morning, and so, you know, I was trying to, you know, do a guy who was a little bit more like the rest of us. You know, he's what I tend to refer to as over. He's overage, he's overweight, he's overly depressed, but he still gets up in the morning and tries to do the job. And to me, that's truer heroism than, you know, these kind of James Bond kind of characters.
Right. But, you know, he's right up there with James Bond. And James Bond is probably one of the most famous fiction characters in the world. And now we have Walt Longmire, you know, stepping into it, almost a first.
Well, and he has a lot more.
I don't know if we've reached that quite that level. Like that, but, yeah, it's nice to see. Like, and I mean, you know, the books are in like about a dozen languages. Mm-hmm. Like at the TV show is showing in like 100 countries. You know, and it's kind of nice like that, because one of the other things I did with Walt was is that, you know, it's not like he doesn't have ghosts, you know, it isn't like he doesn't have, you know, complexities of character and problems that he deals with and all of this, but he still tries to be a good guy. You know, he still gets up in the morning and tries to do the right thing and tries to be a good guy. And, you know, and a lot of times, you know, that's kind of overrated, you know, or, you know, kind of misunderstood and forgotten in the contemporary world. I mean, I don't know how many times I've had, you know, young people come up to me and say, you know, I just really love Walt Longmire. Like, he's such a good guy. Like, and I've never seen a character like that before. And I'm always thinking to myself, okay, you probably never heard of Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and all those guys. Like, but, you know, in many ways, you know, Walt is kind of, you know, and the heritage, you know, of those individuals. You know, he's... You know, he tries to stand up and do the right thing. As my grandfather used to say, try and cover the ground you stand on, is the old phrase that they use. So.
Well, and I think because they're written in the first person, we really get to know him.
Right.
You know, we're living it with him.
You can't get the cards any closer to your vest, you know, when you're working in first person, because, you know, basically, you know, you're in that character's head, you know, for 350, 400 pages. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the humor, you know, that's in the books, like it, is, you know, is from Walt's perspective of the world, the way Walt sees that world. And, you know, and he's a good, strong, you know, centralized character like that. But then again, he also... is completely surrounded, you know, by, you know, all of these really strong, you know, independent female characters, you know, who I think, you know, is another one of the strong suits of the books, and that, you know, they, you know, Walt is kind of damaged goods when you get right down to it. I mean, he's damaged. I mean, his wife being dead, the difficulties in his life, you know, I mean, is he doing a lot of the same difficulties a lot of us ask ourselves about on a day-to-day basis. Are we doing the right thing? Am I doing the best that I can? You know, am I a good person? You know, all these different things, you know, and, you know, thank goodness he has what I tend to refer to as a pride of lionesses around him who are, you know, pretty much responsible, you know, for all the different facets of his life. You know, you've got Dorothy down over the hill at the Busy Bee Cafe who basically makes sure that he stays fed or else he might starve to death. You know,
right.
Left to his own devices. Like, you've got Ruby who leaves the post-its, you know, on his door facing to basically be responsible for the construction of his day-to-day life. So when he comes in the morning, he knows what it is that he's supposed to be doing. You know, you've got his daughter who lives, you know, 2,000 miles away, like, but nonetheless is the last emotional, you know, contact, you know, the last conduit. You know, with his humanity. And then, of course, you've got Vic.
You know,
Victoria Moretti, the transplant from Philadelphia. And she was, you know, a strong construct, you know, in the formula of the books, like in the sense that, you know, she was going to be a counterbalance. I knew that if Walt, if the sheriff was going to be male, the undersheriff had to be female. If the sheriff was rural, you know, the undersheriff probably needed to be urban. If Walt was, you know, more, you know, into the social implications of the job, you know, knowing the history of the county, of knowing, you know, the place and knowing everything about it, you know, the social fabric of it, then, you know, Vic would probably be, you know, more knowledgeable, having gone to a much larger police academy, you know, and the scientific aspects, you
right.
know, the job.
Right.
If Walt is very careful in the type of language that he uses, you know, Vic is very careful in a different way.
Right.
And, you know, it kind of makes for, you know, a good balance as far as the characters are concerned.
Well, and I like Dog. Dog is a really good buddy.
That was one of the buddy. Things that everybody, you know, told me not to do. There were, let's see, two things. Like there were two things. The first one was that they told me, you know, well, don't give your protagonist, you know, because authors are very free with their, you know, advice, you know, whenever you're first starting out, you know, and some of it's good, some of it's maybe not quite so good. Like that, but one of the pieces of advice I got was, well, don't give your protagonist any pets, because then you have to take care of all those pets, you know, and you'll mess up. And I thought, well, I've got a whole ranch full of animals to take care of. I don't see why Walt can't take care of one dog.
There you go.
And so I gave Walt a dog, okay, which I think was probably, you know, accidentally, you know, one of the smartest things I could have done. Because in essence, you know, I'm talking about a man who drives all over Wyoming, you know, an armed man. And I don't know about you guys, but armed people that talk to themselves make me a little bit nervous. I'm glad to have Walt have a dog that he could have these stream of consciousness, you know, kind of like monologues with. And the dog became a very strong character within the books, you know, simply because, you know, by the time I think I got around to the fifth book, one of my favorite sequences of dialogue is when Walt gets out of the truck and he looks around at the dog and says, you know, stay in the truck and don't play with the radio.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, he shuts the door and he takes like two steps and then he says to himself, it was our private joke. He knew he could play with the radio if he wanted.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, a lot of times, like, you know, it's pretty important to have a sounding board, you know, so.
Well, and don't.
And then the other one that they warned me about, and I don't know how much you want to get into this.
Oh, as much as you want.
The other one that everybody warned me about was whenever I first got started was is that you can have like sexual tension, you know, between your characters. But you can't, you know, you can't consummate that. You've got to, like, stretch it out for, like, 17 or 18 books. And my immediate response to that was, what kind of women are you dating? Wait 17 or 18 years for something to happen? And so, you know, whenever somebody gives me a rule, the first thing I always try and do is figure a way to break it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I did immediately. The third book, you know, with Walt and Vic, you know, whenever they had this adventure in Philadelphia, and it's kind of strangers in a strange land and just seemed like the kind of thing where something would happen by accident, you know, and then the final analysis to me, it seems like, you know, when something like that happens to the characters, you really, all it does is complicate their lives. All it is complicate their relationship if you try and handle it correctly. And that's what a series kind of survives on, you know, is the complexities of the characters and the complexities of those relationships. But I was on tour for that book, and I was in Olympia, Washington, and there was a woman in the front row. Like, and I wrote this sex scene was like one paragraph long was all it was. That's how much of a chicken I was. Like, I just, you know, did that sex scene and got out of there. Like, and so I'm in Olympia, Washington, and there's a Q&A session, and there's a woman in the front row, and she's dying to ask a question. I said, yes, ma'am, and she goes, I want to talk to you about that sex scene that's in Kindness Goes Unpunished. And I was like, okay, oh boy, here we go. And I said, yes, ma'am. And she goes, it went on forever.
One paragraph.
it was only a paragraph long. And so everybody started, she started turning bright red, like, and everybody started laughing. And I leaned into her and I said, how many times did you read it? And she goes, I read it a bunch of times. I felt kind of vindicated at that point in time. So.
Well, I think it's partly because you tease us with it. You know, before we get there, and so feels, you know, like it's a longer time than it is.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, you know, it's you know, just because we see Walt, you know, and Vic and Henry and everybody, like, you know, for this, you know, 1 week that that this case is taking place. There's a whole other, you know, months, you know, that are going by,
right,
between books like that. You know, and in one way, that was, you know, one of the big decisions about the constructions of the books also, like that, because I was working on the second book when I won the Tony Hillerman Award and got to have dinner with Tony Hillerman, who was just an absolutely amazing man. I mean, just utterly gracious, and you know, just, you know, whenever you're talking about Western mystery, you know, there are a couple of heads that have to go on the Mount Rushmore of Western mystery, and certainly Tony Hillerman's would be the most prominent. But I was talking with him one day, and I was working on my second book, and he was like on his 20th or something, and I made some remark like, you know, well, how do you do this? You know, and he said, well, at the risk of, you know, sounding like a bad sports analogy, you know, you kind of got to play them up one at a time. And he said, you really need to find some kind of a structure, that will have an effect, you know, on these books, you know, and make each one different. And I started thinking about it. I thought, well, what is the thing that has the largest scale effect on us as Westerners? And I thought, well, the weather is what has the largest scale effect. And so I thought, well, I'm going to pull a Vivaldi is what I tended to refer to it. And so I basically broke the books down into the four seasons. Mm-hmm. You know, the Cold Dish, the first Walt Longmire book, takes place in the fall. Mm-hmm. Death Without Company takes place in the winter. You know, Kindness Goes Unpunished is the spring, and Another Man's Moccasins is the summertime. Like, and so it takes me four books to get through 1 year of Walt's life. And the nice thing about that is that I think that there's a continuity to the books, mm-hmm. that you know, I think is important, you know, because I've read a series of books where all of a sudden they jump 2 years or something, and I'm always thinking to myself, what happened in those 2 years? You know, I want to know what happened with those characters. Mm-hmm. So I think it provides a continuity, you know, to the characters, like in their development, you know, and also to the storylines. But it also provided, you know, a kind of a unique situation where it retarded Walt's physical, you know, aging process. You know, I mean, it takes me 4 years to get through 1 year of Walt's life, which means at one point in time, I'm probably going to be older than Walt. And I don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I'm already older than Walt. So.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but, you know, at some point in time, he's going to be, you know, we're all going to be, you know, not all of
them. Hey, look, we need to put you on hold for just a second. We have to do one of our ads, and then we'll get right back to you.
I'd be delighted.
So hang tough, and we'll be right back to you.
Okay.
Target Freight Truckload, TFM, is a division of Target Freight Management and, quite honestly, the finest truckload company in the United States. If you are looking for a reputable freight company for full truckloads that get to you 100% of the time, call Target Freight TFM Truckload. Call them today. Get a pencil at 1-844-653-7789. Tell them you heard this on the Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something special for you. That number one more time, 1-844-653-7789.
And they're great people. They're great. Thank you, Bobby. You know, we need to go that. Get a pencil. It's that Shirley Temple coming out. Yeah. In and additionally, the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing in Simi Valley, and Out West Boutique and Cultural Center in Newhall.
Old Town Newhall.
And also, if you want to call and talk into Craig Johnson, the number here is 818-602-4929, and quite frankly, I don't know why you wouldn't want to. The guy's just totally amazing.
Call.
I actually have him on hold right now. He isn't blinking yet. So. But anyway, the number here again is 818-602-4929, and we're back with Mr. Craig Johnson. I hope.
We were talking. We were talking a minute ago about the, you know, the four seasons and how the books follow. The very, very first book that I read was Dark Horse when it first came out, and now I've you know, gone back and started with book one and going through the series, and I love the fact that you've laid them out that way, and yet I know a reader could pick up a book anywhere in the series and not feel like he or she doesn't really know what's going on.
Oh, no, I think that's one of the challenges of writing a series of books is that you know, each book does have to kind of stand alone. I mean, they're all going to be interconnected. You know, they're all going to be a part of that development and that over arc, you know, of character. But each one, you know, should be able to stand, you know, unto itself. You know, and then it's just a question of trying to write a different book each time. I mean, if it was, you know, to the point where it was formulaic, you know, I think that I probably would have gotten really tired of writing the book. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the benefits I've got is that, you know, I'm with this really wonderful publisher, Viking Penguin, and they don't give me any kind of qualifications as to what it is that I need to do or how I'm doing it. They just kind of turn me loose, look at and let me do whatever it is that I want to do. And there's a lot of freedom in that, I think, you know, to you know, take on, you know, different social issues, different problems and things like that, that, you know, a lot of times, you know, a lot of it's reserved, you know, for literary fiction, you know, fully developed characters and you know, arcs of storyline like that, you know. But nowadays, you know, people are a little bit more sophisticated readers. You know, they tend to be, you know, they want really good dialogue. They want fully developed characters. They want social commentary. They want humor. They want history. They want all of these things. And then they also want to know who the heck did it by the time they get to the end.
Right.
Right.
Kind of raise the bar and, you know, make it better for everybody, really.
Now, did you know from the very beginning that Henry and Walt, you know, were in Vietnam together, and then you knew that, you know, some books down the road you would write more about that experience? Or did that,
absolutely. That was one of the key elements, I think, you know, of the entire series. It kind of set the tone with the cold dish, you know, with that case. You know, because everybody always asks, they always ask that question, how did you become a writer? Like, there are only two real honest answers to that question. The first one is you run out of excuses. You know, you finally get to the point where you're like, okay, you know, now would be the time to sit down and write that novel that, you know, you've always wanted to write. And you finally do it. You know, you finally sit down and do it. You know, for me, it was, you know, building the ranch. You know, I got the ranch up and going. Everything was all moving right along in my life, you know, but my education was, you know, partially in writing. And I thought, okay, if you're going to write a novel, now would be the time to do it. And then the other one that's probably even more difficult than the discipline of actually writing the book is stumbling onto a story, where you finally stumble onto a story that you think, okay, yeah, this hasn't been done to death. This is something new. It has something to say. And so when I came up with the basic plot line for The Cold Dish, which is there's a young woman, you know, she's a product of fetal alcohol syndrome, a young woman from up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and she's taken into a basement, you know, by these, you know, four young white men in a nearby town and taken advantage of. And they basically get off, you know, with suspended sentences, but then start turning up dead, you know, one by one, shot with a Sharps 45-70 Buffalo rifle. And it's this sheriff's worst nightmare. And with the construction of the books, I knew I had to have, you know, two individuals that were going to be emblematic of the two main cultures, you know, in the High Plains American contemporary West, and that would be on the reservation and off the reservation. And so I needed these two individuals to be somewhat emblematic, and so I thought, okay, well, the sheriff is obviously going to be intimately involved, you know, with this investigation and even the history of this particular crime. Now I need an individual who's going to be emblematic, you know, of the other side of the coin, you know, on the reservation. And that's kind of how the character of Henry came to be. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough, you know, that my ranch is just to the south of the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation, so I have a lot of interaction, you know, up on the res. And, you know, one of the dirty little secrets about my books is that, you know, as much as I borrow from, you know, stealing people all over Wyoming, it's even worse up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, because at least there are 500,000 people in Wyoming for me to borrow from. There's only 5,000 enrolled members up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is the one from Wallace Stegner, where he says, you know, the greatest piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off of anybody alive or dead.
Right.
You know, what a crock that is. I mean, that's your job to go find in your book. And, you know, and the Northern Cheyenne are just incredible people. And fortunately, you know, the books and the television show and everything are very popular up there. And it's gotten to the point now where I actually have, there are people up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation who claim to be characters in my books that I've never met. And so I just take that as a flattering. I take that as a good thing. And I think it's an important thing to try and get across, like at the friendship between those two men also, like it is, you know, one of the hallmarks of the first book and continues
right.
to be the a running thread throughout all the books.
Well, then they grow up together.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, played high school football together, right. Went off to college, like got drafted, you know, ended up in Vietnam, you know, both of them dealing with that, you know, in their own ways, like it, and then did a boomerang, you know, where they came back, you know, to where it was that they were from,
mm-hmm.
To try and find peace, like it, and try and make, you know, their little corner of the world a little bit better place.
I love that you made Henry Standing Bear won't use contractions.
Contractions, right?
Yeah, that's such a great.
You know,
that's such a great piece of writing.
Like bad Indian B movie speak. Look at and there's a friend of mine who actually does that periodically. You know, whenever. You know, he's around people, like, and I asked him about it. I said, why do you do that? And he goes, I do it to piss off white people.
No, that's funny right there. I don't care who you are. So you started writing. You went to school where?
A number of different places. Like, and part of my education was in writing, but I didn't let that get in the way of, you know, becoming a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, a lot of it, you know, was... my education in writing was very valuable to me, but it was also a question of, you know, some of the best stories that I've ever heard have been that, you know, you discussed the first person thing earlier. You know, some of the best stories I've ever heard in my life have been first person, you know, whether it's, you know, crouched across a campfire or, you know, sitting on a front porch in a rocking chair snapping green beans. Like, there's an energy, you know, to that type of storytelling. You know, that kind of like, let me tell you what happened to me last month. And that's kind of what I try and do with the books, is mm-hmm. try and like have it be almost as if, you know, you were sitting on one of the stools in the Busy Bee Cafe in Durant, Wyoming, and Walt Longmire were to come in and sit down next to you and say, let me tell you about what happened to me last month. At that point in time, I don't want you to even remember that you're reading the book. I want you to fall
right.
into that world and be a part, you know, of that world. One of the things I don't do is I don't use the tag phrases he said, she said, which was, you know, the guy that tripped me up on that was actually George Guidel, who does the audio versions of my books and just won a recorded books award for best recorded book just last year for Dry Bones. He's an amazing performer, does an absolutely amazing job. And one of the things he said, well, what's your education in writing? And I said, you know, well, I got a couple of degrees. I said, but, you know, my final degree was actually, you know, believe it or not, in playwriting. And he said, I knew it. And I said, how did you know? Look at, and he goes, you never use the tag phrases he said, she said. You always use, you know, some sort of physical action or descriptive passage to let me know who is the character that's speaking and then deliver the dialogue. And he said, for me, that's a lot, you know, a lot better simply because when I'm, you know, performing a book as a recorded book, it's like performing a 350 or 400 page novel or a play rather.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, every time you say, he said, she said, all you're doing is reminding people that they're having a book read to them, you know, rather than having them be submerged into that world. And it was interesting, I thought, you know, and that was, you know, a roundabout way to get back to, the, you know, answering your question. But, for me, the big question there was, is like, you know, I thought, you know, these playwright guys, they seem to know a lot about dialogue. You know, maybe if I, you know, take enough time to, you know, to work on a, you know, a playwriting degree enough to learn some dialogue. And so that was in Temple University in Philadelphia, which is where the Philadelphia connection came from and actually where I met my wife. I think it worked to my benefit like that because I don't back away from dialogue very much. You know, for me, dialogue is just a joy, you know, to sit down and work on.
Yeah, me too.
I'm sorry, what?
I said me too. I love doing dialogue.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's fun. You know, it's the fast stuff. I mean, the descriptive passages, you know, you really have to sit down and think about, you know, a new way of saying things, like, which is the term that my wife uses and is the most frightening phrase to be heard at the Johnson Ranch. You know, whenever my wife is reading my work back to me, and I'm always telling students, I'm always saying, you know, well, you know, have somebody read your work back to you, and you'll hear every mistake that you ever made. You know, don't read it yourself. Have somebody read it back to you. You know, because you'll edit on the fly and try and fix stuff. But if somebody's reading it back to you, the most horrifying phrase here at the ranch is there another way to say this? it's the most scary, you know, words you can have uttered here at the ranch. I mean, because, you know, the red-hot gun barrel, you know, swung around under the looming mountains. You know, well, the gun barrel is always red-hot. The mountains are always looming. Like, and so you're always looking for another way to say this. Is there another way to say something? You know, because, you know, substantially, you know, a lot of the time, you know, we as writers, you know, we become lazy. Like, and we heard a phrase that, you know, sounded good, and we just, you know, regurgitate that same phrase or those same words. And that's not our job. You know, our job is to try and keep that reader awake. You know, you're not supposed to put them to sleep at the end of the day. You're supposed to, you know, keep them up until 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, reading chapters, trying to figure out what's going on with these characters.
Yes, that's me.
What's assembling in their lives.
That is Bobby Jean.
Yes, I read many of these books all the way through the night, and I was very anxious to read sections aloud to my husband, Jim. It was the book's call to be read aloud, and I understand now more about, you know, what you've done to make that happen. There were so many scenes where I was eager to say, "Oh, you got it. Let me read this to you." You know, there was a fight scene in particular. I think it's in Dark Horse, and he's in like a boxing ring, and you know, you just can't put Walt down. He just keeps getting back up and getting back up. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm reading now. I'm in book 5, and I wish I'd been keeping a diary as I'd been reading through the 5 books at that point of how many fights he'd been in, how many bones had been broken, how many times he'd been shot or had avoided being shot, how many beers had he drunk, you know?
Yeah, and you know what is really great is that you chose to let him drink Rainier beer.
Rainier beer.
Hey, you know what? You know, I it was one of those things where I thought, you know, Walt's kind of old school. He's kind of blue collar. You know, he's not going to drink a blueberry microbrew.
No.
Probably going to have to be something, you know, that's, you know, a little further down the road. So I started glancing around and thinking, okay, well, you know, what are any of these old, like, you know, working class, you know, blue collar, you know, beers left, you know, and so a lot of them have been bought up, you know, by the big corporations and stuff. But there were still a few floating around out there, and a couple I was looking at. One was Grain Belt out of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I was looking at that because that was that's a good beer. And then Ole, Olympia, like that was another one I was looking at. And then I finally kind of settled on Rainier, which was kind of a happenstance kind of thing like that. But the books always kind of like tend to lean more towards the Northwest, you know, maybe more so than the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the funny things that happened, though, was that whenever I first started doing library events, you know, here in Wyoming, there was a little town over in the western part of the state in Meteetse, which is a population of 351. So that's a big town in Wyoming. And they asked me to come over and do a library event and asked me what my honoraria would be.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know that authors charged libraries to do, you know, events. And so I said, well, a 6-pack of Rainier beer cans preferred. You know, well, the problem was I got in all of the newspapers in Wyoming, and subsequently I have done every library in Wyoming. Like
for a 6-pack of Rainier beer.
I haven't bought beer in about 7 years, so it's worked out actually pretty good for all of us.
Like, well, I like Rainier.
What happened was I had the little novella that I wrote, Spirit of Steamboat, that was picked up as the first state read, you know, for the state of Wyoming. And I was down at the Capitol in Cheyenne at the state library, and the state librarian, you know, brought the, you know, the 18-pack of, you know, of Rainier out. I've graduated from a 6-pack to an 18-pack, in case I hadn't mentioned that. You know, I had to up my price a little bit, you know, to make it more competitive. Like, and so they bring this 18-pack of Rainier beer out, and they set it down, and she looks at me, and she says, this was kind of hard to get. And I said, well, yeah, I know. It's kind of a working-class beer, so a lot of the, you know, bars don't carry it anymore. And she goes, no, you don't understand. The distributors had a hard time getting it. And I said, well, yeah, I know. If the bars don't carry it, the distributors don't carry it. She goes, no, you still don't understand. They're out of beer. This was about 2 weeks into the TV show Longmire.
Uh-huh, with the Rainier.
And everybody saw Walt drinking Rainier beer, and they all went out and bought it, for gosh sakes. And so I thought it sounded a little funny, so I thought I would check it out. And their headquarters, the corporate headquarters, is actually in Irwindale, California, down there near where you guys are.
Like,
and so I call up the headquarters, and I said, hey, you know, are you guys having a problem? We are out of beer. We are totally out of beer. We've been brewing this stuff since Prohibition, and we've had such a huge spike in sales, and we have no idea what's going on. And I said, well, I have what we call in my business a clue. And so I told him about Longmire and, you know, about the sheriff in Wyoming and how the TV show, you know, was the highest rated scripted drama and, you know, in the network's history and all this stuff. Like, and they were very excited. We had a really wonderful conversation, about 5 or 10 minutes or so. And when we finished up, it was kind of funny because the guy there, he said, you know, well, don't worry because we're in full production. So it'll be back on the shelves here in about, you know, probably, you know, like 4 or 5 days, which kind of gives you an indication of how long it takes to make Rainier beer. You know,
there's a reason for that.
In fine oak casks, you know, in the Olympic Peninsula, you probably need to rethink that one. But anyway, it seems to have turned out to be pretty well. For
yeah, they used to brew it right off the freeway in Seattle.
Oh yeah, right there off I-5.
Right off I-5. Yeah, I'm a Northwest boy, so.
And they just now put the big R back up on top of the building too. Like that, so.
Yeah, did they?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, the original ones, I think, in the Industrial Museum in Seattle, like that, but there was a big collection, like everybody chipped in and they built a new one and put it back up on top of the building.
Oh, cool. I haven't been to Seattle. That's a nice lie. I was there last May. We're looking at Henry and seeing if Henry wants to jump in here anywhere.
Henry has a question or comment.
You know, I was thinking it's an unusual thing for an author to be continuing to write his novels about his character when he's got a hugely successful TV show based on the characters. I was thinking, I know Earl Stanley Gardner, when he was writing his Perry Mason novels, after they became a very popular series, he started re-describing Perry so that he looked like Raymond Burr. Has the series affected at all the way you write the stories?
Not really. I mean, because an awful lot of the, a lot of the characters are based off of friends and family, neighbors, you know, people I've worked with and everything. And so, you know, those voices and those images are so strong, you know, it would be very difficult for the TV show to supplant that. Not that, you know, the TV show is marvelous. And I'm a creative consultant on the show, like, you know, and the cast are all really good friends. You know, all the technical people, the crew and everybody are all good friends. And I go down, like, twice a year down to New Mexico where it's filmed around Santa Fe and spend time. And all the actors actually come up here to Buffalo, Wyoming, a little town of 4,000 people for Longmire Days, where we have the cast and about 14,000 of their closest friends who all come up for about that third week in July. So I really enjoy the TV show a great deal, and the performances I think are just absolutely magnificent. But I was writing the books, you know, for 7 years, you know, before Warner Brothers and Netflix and everybody got in touch with me, to kind of give you an indication of what that's like. When I wrote the Cold Dish, I sent away, you know, the manuscript, you know, to my mother and father, and I also sent a copy to my brother. And I think I waited a full 48 hours, you know, as the young aspiring author before I started badgering them, you know, with phone calls as to whether it was that they had, you know, read this manuscript or not. And I call up my brother and I said, hey, have you read that manuscript I sent over? And he said, yeah, I have, and you're dead. What do you mean? Like, and he goes, Craig, the old sheriff that Walt goes and plays chess with on Tuesday nights, Lucian, that's our dad. I thought I hid that really well. And he said, no, he looks like Dad, he acts like Dad, he talks like Dad. The only thing he did was cut off one of his legs. I don't think that's going to fool Dad. So I said, I got to go. And he goes, I bet you do. Like, so I immediately call up my mother and father, and my mother answered the phone, like that, and I asked her, I said, you know, Mom, have you been reading that manuscript I sent over? And she goes, oh, yeah, honey, I'm about halfway through. It's so good. I mean, she's my mother. What's she going to say?
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's crap.
I said, has Dad read any of it yet? And she goes, oh, yeah, he's about two-thirds of the way through. And I'm thinking, he definitely read the Lucian parts. I'm trying to think how I'm going to ask this next question. And she comes back on the phone, and she goes, honey, your father thinks he's Walt Longmire. And so, you know, I'm sitting there, you know, and anybody's read my books knows how far apart those two characters are. And so I'm trying to think how I'm going to ask the next question. She comes back on the phone again, and she says, let's not disabuse him of that thought, shall we? And so you know, all the way to his grave, my father was pretty sure that he was Walt Longmire. And I remember writing that in one of my newsletters, and there were a bunch of people that wrote back and said, we all think we're Walt Longmire. Don't worry about it. So,
yeah.
We're all trying to be.
There you go. Hey, look, I need to steal another minute of your time to do another commercial, and then we'll get right back to you.
Absolutely.
Okay, hang tough. Hey, you LTL shippers out there. Chances are you're looking for a great company to help you move your freight. Well, look no further. Target Freight Management is and should be your company of choice. Their customized transportation management system is just a ticket to get your freight moving the way you want it to move. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com. That's 1-888-653-1323. Give them a call. You won't be sorry. We use them at my business, and we just love them to death. And hello to everybody in Pittsburgh. And we're back in studio with Craig Johnson.
Are you going to be in the L.A. area at all this year?
I actually am. I'm trying to think about, I've got a schedule ahead of me, but I don't know which one it is. This year is a little bit different from others like that because I've actually got two books coming out this year. They kind of switched around my pub date. I used to be in May like that, but with the power of Netflix and the power of Warner Brothers, it looks like my new pub date is going to be in September. But they were afraid that people would not want to wait 4 months, for another book. And so I've actually got another little book. It's a novella that's a lot like Spirit of Steamboat. It's called The Highwayman. That'll be out in May. So I'll be touring twice this year, looking forward to it.
Well, we have Bobby Jean's eyes lit up.
We need to know when you're coming to town.
We will move anybody out of this studio to get you in here.
Knowing, at this point in time, I'm lucky if I know what I'm doing tomorrow.
You have a wonderful website, and to any of our listeners that are listening, go to just craigjohnson.com, and there's so much wonderful information there. And there is a page with your schedule, and I'm sure that'll get updated. But you have a great website.
Speaking of, I probably should have updated it last week. We're going to get on that. I promise.
Yeah, it's still December.
Yeah.
That's Craig Allen Johnson. Is that not correct?
Yes, craigallenjohnson.com.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I was just there this afternoon.
Yeah, so. I was spending some time there too, yes.
We tend to try to do our homework. We don't always make it.
I appreciate that. I do.
I actually got Netflix today.
Is that a birthday present or what?
Absolutely.
Anybody?
Do you want to ask the question?
We can ask the question. We like to ask all the writers, and I'll warn you ahead of time, we have had answers to there's no such thing, or I don't know, or I rewrite chapters. Have you ever had writer's block?
No, never have. I'm a firm believer in outlining the living daylights out of my books. Simply because I tend to refer to what I write as being socially responsible crime fiction. I'm not looking to stack up bodies like cordwood. I'm usually trying to have something to say. And one of the most important things that you say in a piece of crime fiction is who did it. And so you kind of need to know that information, before you start in on a book. I mean, every once in a while I'll hear an author say, I just start a book and see where it goes. That just scares the living daylights out of me. There's no way I would sit down to do a year's worth of work and just, see where it went. I'm a big one for outlining. I do very detailed outlines of, scenes, of chapters, of the entire book. And there are a couple of benefits that go along, with having that kind of an outline. One is that it provides you with an ability to pace your book. One of the things I've noticed that an awful lot of beginning authors, a lot of the trouble that they have is the pacing is off in their books. It doesn't really have a particular pace to it. It doesn't, grow or, ebb and flow, the way that it should. It's impossible to know, what the pace of a book is unless, you can kind of see the structure of that book, and so that's why I think it's very important to be able to have an outline where you can see, I'm really expository, heavy in the last two-thirds of the book, I'm very action-heavy at the beginning, I've got to change this around and move this around, and when you've got an outline, you can do that rather than going back and, and rewriting the whole book, over and over and over again, which I do anyway, but hopefully not to have to restructure it all like that because I didn't do the homework that I needed to do beforehand. Mm-hmm. The other thing that, an outline guards against is writer's block, which I think is just not knowing what happens next. If you've got an outline and you've got something that shows you where it is that you're going and what it is that you're doing, then you can write towards that and not find yourself in some dead-end street where, you have no idea what it was that you wrote that or where it was going or what was going to happen. Writing time for me is always very important. You know, it's essential. Like that, you know, and you know, I don't have a lot of time to waste to just kind of see, you know, where things go. I need to know where things are going and try and head in that direction.
Do you write every day or have a certain amount of time, you know, a schedule that you stick to?
I do. Like I'm kind of a blue collar, you know, writer. You know, I get things up and going here on the ranch and get everything kind of squared away, and then, you know, I come back up to the house, and then I've got a loft up here like that I go up to, and I just, which is where I'm actually speaking from now. And I sit down at my desk, you know, and I work. I work all morning, like at into the afternoon, and then stop, you know, have lunch with my wife, work all the way through until the evening. Like it, and, you know, it's usually, you know, it's guaranteed 6 days a week, and I usually cheat on the seventh day. You know, because I've got something in my head that's, you know, kind of like, you know, clawing at me a little bit. And even if I'm trying to take that one day off, I end up coming up and, you know, working on it just a little bit, just to, you know, advance the progression.
Are you disciplined in that way that you absolutely will sit there for 6 hours and write?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are enough things in life that, you know, that intrude. You know, that you don't have to plan for them, like that, especially, you know, when you've got a ranch, you know, and all these things that are happening. You know, I mean, I travel, you know, a great deal, you know, with the tours here in the U.S. Then there's also the foreign tours. I spend a lot of time in Europe, you know, touring over there, too. Like that, and, you know, there are always things that will pull you away from the writing, like that. And so, you know, I don't need to, you know, when on the writing days, like that, I need to be able to sit down in the chair, like that, and, you know, and be in that world, like, and take advantage of the time that's available to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're running short of time. If you would like to give us all your information, your Facebook, your website again, where people can contact you, if you would do that for us, sir, we would truly adore, I'd love it.
I'll be happy to. Like, the website's pretty easy. It's craigallenjohnson.com. It's CraigAllenJohnson.com. And I've, you know, we've got all kinds of tons of information there, including clips, you know, from the television show.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook page, like that, is actually somewhat complex. It's Craig Johnson, the guy in the cowboy hat, but it's also got a blue check mark to show you that it is the official Craig Johnson Facebook page. So that you're not out there, you know, getting a lot of information from people who I don't know. and then let's see, we got season 5, like that of. Of Longmire should be. I guess they're going to start filming. I guess here at the beginning of March, and they'll be filming all the way through until June, and then we've got Longmire Days in Buffalo, Wyoming, on the third week of July. So if you're feeling the need to come and hobnob, you know, with the actors and see what the real Absaroka County is like, you know, maybe Longmire Days might appeal to you. Mm-hmm. In May, like that, I do have another book coming out. It's called The Highwayman. And it's about a highway patrolman by the name of Rosie Wayman, who's been a reoccurring character, you know, in the books. Like that, and she gets switched over to Troop G in the Wind River Canyon, which is a really spectacular portion of Wyoming, up above the Wind River Reservation. It's actually called No Man's Land by all the highway patrolmen because there are 2,000-foot granite peaks on either side, and radio frequency is kind of off and on again sometimes in that area. And she gets transferred to that area and starts getting these 1078 calls every couple of nights. 1078 call, officer needs assistance. 1078, officer needs assistance. The problem being the officer that's requiring her assistance died back in 1979.
Oh,
and, I got to read that.
Get her sent in for a psychological evaluation. Walton Henry.
Sign me up. I want to pre-order that.
Maybe I'll be in L.A. and we can talk about that.
Cool.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you have time and you're in L.A., let us know. We'll move people. We'll get you in the studio with us.
Or meet you for lunch,
deal.
Or show up wherever you're going to
or,
be.
Oh yeah, we'll just show up. Hey, I'm going to be sending you a coffee mug that has our logo for our show on it, so enjoy that.
Cool.
And thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's just been delightful.
This has really been
absolutely fun.
It's,
please, all mine. Hopefully this is the beginning of numerous shows to come.
Well, yeah. I hope so. And you know what? You're free to come back on whenever you want to.
You can call.
And you can call.
Cool.
Just call in.
You'll always be welcome.
I know some people out there. Like, maybe I can get Lou Diamond Phillips come in with me.
Oh,
you know, I ran into
that.
Him in a BevMo in Simi Valley one day.
Did you?
I did.
Was he buying Rainier beer?
He was buying spring water, right?
I didn't realize he was
tonic water.
He's big.
He is. I laugh about that because every time, you know, whenever people watch the TV show, they're like, well, now, you know, Henry's a big guy in the books. And I'm like, well, now Lou's like a little over 6 feet.
Yeah,
know,
he's
like
about 6'1". Yeah, he's,
you know,
a, he's
I think
pretty
there's
buff.
A reason for that. I think what he explained to me what the reasoning was is that in Young Guns, all those other guys were all really short, and so they put him on the short horse.
Everybody
out, so they all think he's a short guy, but he's really not.
No, he's not. No. And I went to school with A. Martinez.
Now he's one of my favorites. He is an absolutely a doll of a human being.
Well, you know, he actually acted the way he does on the TV show in real life when we were in high school.
You know, he did that when he was up here. He was the manager for the Indians. We have and during Longmire days, we had the Cowboys versus the Indians softball game. Like, and he managed as the Night Horse character. Like, and it was absolutely one of the funniest evenings I've ever had.
Every time I see him, I want to smack him.
He was trying to trade players during the course of the game. He was trying to rewrite the rule book. It was one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my entire life. He was fantastic.
Well, look, we need to get going, but thanks again for coming on with us. It's just been a great evening.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure.
Good.
I hope to talk to you guys again.
Oh, I hope we do.
Thanks.
And we'll say goodnight to you, Craig.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Was that fun or what?
Oh, my gosh. That guy's just, he's, that you don't want to say anything.
No,
I mean, the guy just,
no.
His stories are great.
Yeah. We need to have, you know, several episodes.
I know,
like,
huh?
You know, we need to have session one, session two, session, you know. That was really fun.
Well, we're going to turn it over to Henry and see what you got to tell us, Henry.
Minutes. Well, thank you. You know, I've had such a great first week of 2016. That I can't imagine the rest of the year living up to it. It's been all interviews for various articles for True West and Henry's Western Roundup. This week, from the just-wrapped Spaghetti Western, The Price of Death, I spoke to star Crispian Belfrage in London and writer-director Danny Garcia in Spain. I spoke to John Cassar, the Emmy-winning director and producer of the series 24, about his new Western, Forsaken, which stars father and son Donald Sutherland and Kiefer Sutherland and Demi Moore, a really fine traditional Western, and it's got the best saloon gunfight that I've seen since John Wayne's last in The Shootist.
Mm-hmm.
Then yesterday, I interviewed the great James Drury, the Virginian.
Really?
Yeah, he's got an event, the 6th annual Cowboy Up for Veterans in Ohio this April, and he's brought together all the 10 remaining stars from the Virginian for it. And today I interviewed the great Robert Duvall. Is that
what?
Cool?
In
what
person or by
what
the
a day
on phone?
You had, January 7th.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, you know, he won his Oscar for Tender Mercies, but I think we'll all always remember
Lonesome Dove.
Gus McRae. You know, Lonesome Dove. Boy, I bet he wishes he owned the rights to that hat.
Oh.
He designed that hat, and, well, you know, Bobby, how many of those sell.
But, the Gus hat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, as a matter of fact, he and Tommy Lee Jones and all of the leads from Lonesome Dove are having a reunion and series of events in Texas to celebrate the 28th anniversary of the series.
It's been 28 years. 28.
Oh, my gosh.
They should have done something the 25th. Wow. Would have made more sense, but better late.
Yeah.
Now, so with all these interviews I've been doing that I have to transcribe, I'm going to have to push off the roundup until not this Sunday, but next Sunday, the 17th.
Okay.
So with that in mind, let me mention that a week from Saturday at the Autry, they're going to be screening The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
One of my personal favorites.
Isn't that a great picture?
It's
and
a good
to
picture.
To see on a screen, especially. And TCM and Fathom Events are starting their year of special events on Sunday the 17th, screening Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 650 theaters across the country.
Wow.
Are they really?
Wow.
Yeah. Did they put any deleted scenes back in?
Not that I know of, but I know they have a new introduction, you know, done by the TCM hosts.
Uh-huh.
But is there much stuff missing from that?
I think there is. I want to say Robert Redford said at one time that there was about 40 minutes they had to cut out.
Holy cow.
Because they had to really shorten it up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's such a great movie.
Oh, it is.
Talk about a buddy film. Holy crap.
And so few people, you know, now have ever seen it on a big screen.
Right.
So. They're going to be, you know, 650 times chances, and it's going to be Sunday the 17th and Wednesday the 20th, so all around the country. So,
650 screens.
That's right.
Wow.
And you know,
you're awful quiet.
Let's see. And, and for anyone who hasn't read the current roundup yet, I have my reviews of The Hateful Eight and a very atmospheric and tough Civil War Western thriller called The Keeping Room. It's about three Southern women in a ruined plantation trying to survive, which isn't easy when General Sherman is on his way. Mm-hmm. His foragers are set ahead to destroy supplies. It stars Britt Marling, True Grit's Haley Steinfeld, playing the antithesis of Mattie Ross. If you remember how you know how controlled and controlling she was, this is she's like the spoiled, irresponsible little sister. So it's quite a change. And Muna Otari, Otaru as their slave. And what I'm not exactly sure because now it's you know another week off what I'm going to be doing in the roundup. But I've got a very good pair of interviews I've done recently, so I'm probably either going to have my interview with Bruce Boxleitner or my interview with Darby Hinton. Do you remember him? He played Israel Boone.
Yes.
Daniel Boone.
Yeah. It was a kid.
He was a kid, but he's like 55 now. And actually, he just starred in a very interesting TV movie for the Weather Channel about the Donner Party. And he plays George Donner.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And he was so good.
Wow. Yeah, I always remember him as Israel.
Right. Little Israel.
Little Israel.
But, of course, he was big because, you know, Bess Parker and, oh, what's her name, the beautiful redhead who played as
Patricia Blair?
Yes, Patricia Blair. So, I mean, well, she was so tall, she was always on all the tall westerns. You know, she was the girlfriend of Chuck Connors.
Right,
the Rifleman.
On a Rifleman.
For a season and somewhere else, the Big Valley, or you know, wherever there were tall guys, Patricia Blair would be there.
Wow. Well, I'm afraid it's time for us to say goodnight.
What a great show. What a wonderful way to kick off 20, what year is it? 16.
And I did read your blog, incidentally. And thank you for the shout out.
Oh, you betcha.
And we are going to be back next Thursday with Bill Wilbur.
Yes.
The sidewalk writer.
Oh, Bill's a wonderful guy. It'll be really fun to have
him. No, he actually will sit on a chair in front of people, and they'll throw stuff at him, and then he, words, and he'll write
words,
a story.
Yes, not, they don't throw
he'll
things
write,
at
He'll
him.
Write a story about it right there on the spot.
Yep.
He's the most dangerous writer in America, he said. And he'll be in here with his producer. That I guess they're making a movie out of Saragossa. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll be in here with his producer next week. And the following week, I do not remember who's here.
I think it's Choi Smith.
If we can get a hold of him.
Oh, okay.
And then the following week is Jillian Boyd with Russ. And that's
concert series. And I'm first of our concert series
right,
for this year.
So that's going to be exciting for you guys.
Yes, absolutely.
So and other than that, gentlemen, ladies, thank you so much. All our listener out there. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday with the Writer's Block. And we are officially gone.